Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. St. Louis Public Radio first talked with our next guest in 2013, when he was just 12 years old. By that time, his Wake Up to Politics newsletter had been up and running for a few years and had nearly 600 subscribers. Well, fast forward more than a decade, Gabe Fleischer recently graduated from Georgetown University, where his Wake Up to Politics newsletter, which now is on Substack, is closing in on 50,000 subscribers. Fleischer joins us now to talk about the evolution of his journalism and what he's paying attention to in the home stretch of the presidential race. Gabe, welcome to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Thanks so much for having me.
Gabe, I mentioned we'd talk about the evolution of your journalism, and to do that, I want to hear from someone very important, and that's you, talking with St. Louis Public Radio in 2013 in the library at Brittany Woods Middle School in University City about the origins of Wake Up to Politics.
I started this sending it to my mom, and just because I've always been really interested in politics, and it kind of grew from there as my mom sent it to her parents and our family and friends. And I just think it's really important to inform people about what's going on, about their government. And so I've been doing it ever since to larger and larger audiences.
So Gabe, hearing yourself from 2013, what comes to your mind when you think of how far you've come since that point in time?
Well, weird to hear myself, for starters. It's weird to hear my voice from. That was obviously a long time ago, though I do remember talking to you in the library, as long ago as it was. I don't know. I mean, it's definitely weird to think back. It's been quite a journey. It's been certainly an unusual journey through journalism. I don't know if you had told me then that I'd still be doing the newsletter now, you know, 11 years later. I don't know if I quite would have believed you. Certainly would not have believed I've been able to have the audience that I've had, been able to have the experience that I've had. I don't know that I would have believed I'm here in D.C., you know, covering in person, you know, the institutions of government that I kind of followed so closely from St. Louis when I was so young. So it is pretty crazy to kind of think back and think of the trajectory.
So if you are not one of the almost 50,000 subscribers to Wake Up to Politics, can you describe it for people who may not have heard of it before?
Yeah, for sure. So Wake Up to Politics, it's a daily email newsletter, like you said, coming through Substack, comes out every weekday morning, basically covering national politics, trying to cover politics, I mean, certainly from a nonpartisan angle, trying to cover it, you know, from not as a dramatic standpoint as I think other news outlets, trying to take a bit more of a calmer tone, trying to focus on kind of bipartisanship, things getting done in Washington. I do every Friday. I did just this morning. A feature on what Congress is actually doing, what's getting done, what are kind of the bipartisan pieces of legislation that are getting through, the kind of, you know, substantive legislation that might not be, you know, as flashy or partisan, but is actually kind of making a difference in people's lives that aren't getting as much coverage. That's a big feature of the newsletter that I focus on every day and especially every Friday. But it's kind of just trying to cover politics from that kind of angle, to trying to give people a place where they can stay informed and follow what's going on in national politics, but not in a way that makes them, you know, feel so exhausted or angry or depressed all the time, even though obviously there can sometimes be a lot of depressing stuff going on.
As a former state government reporter who covered the legislature in Jefferson City, I'm curious about what your process is for writing about Congress, given that the House and Senate operate in kind of an opaque and confusing manner. Like, how do you go about doing what you do when you write about Congress?
It's a great question. I mean, you know, it's a mix of things. It's a mix of, you know, I'm able to kind of, sometimes I will go to Congress, and, you know, then the nice thing about, you know, Congress, you know, as opaque as it can be sometimes, if you're there in the halls of the House and Senate, you know, the members of Congress, there is a pretty free-flowing atmosphere where members will talk to reporters. You can kind of go and do reporting that way. I was just at the Capitol yesterday, actually not covering a vote or anything, but covering something called the Congressional Hackathon, which was an event going on, kind of a symposium focused on kind of ways to make Congress work better. So I was covering that just yesterday on the Hill. So sometimes it's that, but sometimes it's honestly, not even focused on, you know, kind of talking to members themselves, but just looking what's going on the floor. I spend a lot of time looking at the congressional record, kind of paging through, trying to find these kinds of more little noticed pieces of legislation that can have a big impact. And then I try to read the bills myself. I see what's going on in them, try to reach out to the members' offices to try to talk to them about it, but then also trying to talk to, you know, outside groups and advocates, trying to learn more about what these bills will do. Like I said, I wrote a piece this morning about some of the bills that have passed this past week. I wrote about a child welfare bill that will really kind of overhaul the foster care system. So I talked to activists this week who are working for that piece of legislation. I covered a bill that will kind of improve executive branch transparency. I was talking to some groups that are working on a kind of good government groups working on those goals. So it's kind of covering it from all sorts of angles, both kind of inside the institution itself, but then also trying to look outside at who are the groups kind of putting pressure on them to get things done and what's actually moving through.
Are you a one-man show here, or do you have some help in terms of, like, how you're able to functionally cover things like Congress?
Yeah, it's just me, one-man show.
I salute your energy and enthusiasm.
Thank
there.
You.
I'm curious about how the Missouri delegation in the House and Senate is viewed by national political reporters. You mentioned the child welfare bill that came out of Ways and Means Committee Chairman Jason Smith's committee, and he's from Missouri. Would you say that Missouri's delegation makes an impact in Congress, or are they seen as kind of like an afterthought?
I mean, I think there's certainly, you know, I think it goes member by member. There's certainly, like you said, there's a few committee chairs from Missouri, including Chairman Smith, as you said, who, yes, was a big champion of that child welfare bill. That was like a year-long review from the Ways and Means Committee that resulted in that bill that Smith was very involved in. Obviously, Senator Hawley is fairly high profile. You see him. And again, to kind of go to, you know, I think he's interesting because I think not just, you know, gets a lot of headlines for, I think, kind of more partisan stuff, and, you know, he's certainly kind of like a go-to quote in terms of, you know, he's a close Trump ally, but also in terms of the coverage that I do in terms of bipartisan legislation, he's also had some very interesting partnerships on bipartisan pieces of legislation, including on banning congressional stock trading and stuff like that. He's worked with like John Ossoff on kind of, you know, mutual bedfellows on the left and right that he's worked with. Obviously, there's a lot of national coverage, as you know, and I know you covered it closely, of the Cori Bush race. She's certainly a member who has made a lot of waves down here. So I think it's member by member. I think there's probably some that fly under the radar more than others, but there's certainly ones. I mean, Ann Wagner, I think, is certainly known as, you know, somewhat of a workhorse, someone who also works a lot of bipartisan pieces of legislation. So there's certainly members, Missouri members, who kind of pull their weight on Capitol Hill, I would say.
I have a more mechanical question for you. Is it difficult to get members of Congress to speak to you, especially when the two chambers are in session? Because my stereotypical vision of covering Congress involves, like, dozens, if not hundreds, of reporters circling a lawmaker as they like walk to their next meeting. Is that what it's like every day, or is that really only during high profile House Senate showdowns, like on government shutdown, for example?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely exacerbated during those periods. I think there's definitely days you go to the Hill and it's a lot quieter, and there's, I mean, small circles of reporters trailing them, not quite as many as on other days. And also, I would say, varies member by member. I think sometimes, you know, if you'll see someone, you know, especially, you know, if you'll see like Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema at a time when they're like a key vote, you'll see huge scrums around them. And then, but maybe if you want to talk to a member who isn't as flash or getting as much attention, you know, usually you'll see them kind of walking alone and maybe you're able to catch them. So I would say it kind of depends. Certainly, yeah, in terms of that aspect of it, can be difficult just to kind of like make your voice be heard among the scrum. It's also, you know, there's difficulties obviously coming from an independent news outlet. I think, you know, the knowledge about kind of Substack news outlets is growing on Capitol Hill and across Washington, but it's still, you know, there's certainly still a bias towards kind of more mainstream established news organizations. So that can be difficult. So a lot of it is kind of relationship building, getting the members to know you and getting their staffs to know you. And also kind of, I think, when you do kind of prove yourself as someone who's doing coverage, not just of kind of the fireworks and kind of flashy stuff, but if you do show your work and show that you want to talk to a member, you know, a lot of these members, a lot of them under the surface are kind of actually policy wonks. And if you show, you know, I don't want to talk to you about Trump or Kamala Harris or anything like that. Like, I want to talk to you about like this piece of legislation you're working on that you've been working on for months, that you and your staff have put a lot of time in. Oftentimes they're a lot more open to those sorts of requests than maybe to talk about the things that are kind of driving the big headlines.
You mentioned Substack, and I actually want to talk about that platform, because to me it seems like a throwback to the 2000s when blogs were really popular for political dissemination. That was certainly how I got my start in 2006 at the Columbia Daily Tribune. Then blogs kind of became passé with the rise of things like Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, Instagram, but it does seem like Substack has been a destination of sorts for, like, independent journalists. Like, why do you think Substack in particular has become popular among people like you?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, it is a bit of a throwback. I would agree to kind of the blogging era, but I think the crucial difference and the reason why I really kind of went to that from, like you said, I just graduated college. I've been doing this newsletter a long time, but, you know, I wasn't sure whether I'd want to continue independent, you know, out of college, whether, you know, what would make the most sense for me. And I think what is nice about Substack is you do have complete editorial independence, so you do have that sort of freedom, you know, in my case, kind of cover the stories I want to cover. You have no one, you know, you don't have a corporate, you know, kind of parent that's kind of, you know, telling you what to cover and what not to. So you do have that independence, but you're also part of this network of independent journalists. And I think, you know, if you go back to the blogging days, you're talking about there was something of a culture of different blogs, you know, kind of linking to each other and trying to boost each other. But there was no kind of institutionalized platform where independent writers could all be on together. You can, you know, really boost your readership a lot by, you know, there's all these sorts of network effects and recommendation features where, you know, I can recommend other people's newsletters. They can recommend mine. So when people are signing up for my newsletter, they'll see other independent writers I like that they might want to read, and vice versa when they sign up for their newsletters. So I think it's this nice kind of middle ground where it is still independent, but then there's also this kind of larger institution backing you and giving you a network connecting you to other independent writers. So it's a bit of a middle ground, I would say, between kind of, you know, being totally out on your own, but then, you know, kind of being in kind of a larger institution.
We're talking with Gabe Fleischer, a St. Louis County native who is the author of Wake Up to Politics on Substack. So let's turn to the presidential election. We talked in the last segment that states like Missouri and Illinois are kind of lost in the shuffle compared to Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Michigan. I'm curious if the lack of competitive states makes this election slightly less interesting to cover than, say, 2008 or 2012 when there were more swing states. I mean, even when asking that question, I'm like, this has been an extremely interesting presidential election to cover. But I do wonder if, like, the intense focus on just seven states has kind of made the actual mechanics of this race kind of monochromatic for a lot of reporters. What do you think about that?
It's a good question. I mean, there's no question the kind of battleground map has kind of shrunk. I wouldn't say that's necessarily new to this cycle. I would say, you know, these are roughly the same seven states, you know, we are kind of really laser focused on at the very least the last two cycle. I think you're right. I mean, obviously going back to 2008, Missouri was a battleground state. So it wasn't so long ago that, you know, we had a fairly different map. But this map has been fairly settled for a few cycles now. So I wouldn't say that's new. I mean, it is, I think that offers certain challenges for reporters because I do think, you know, it does necessitate a lot of travel to, you know, those same kind of states, a lot of reminders to readers, you know, when looking at polls, you know, it's not always the national polls that matters. It's really about these battleground state polls. So it does require, you know, a difference in how you're covering and talking about the elections. I think it's hard, like you say, to call this election uninteresting. I think for a while, you know, this was something of a static race. We were having a rematch between two candidates who had run 4 years before, who were already deeply unpopular. And then on top of the fact, as you say, you know, we are talking about this kind of pretty narrow map where not too many voters were going to, you know, kind of judge the outcome. I think, you know, that's obviously really shifted, you know, over the course of the summer. So I wouldn't quite say it's been an uninteresting race to cover. It's you know, between assassination attempts and candidates dropping out and coming in at the last minute, it's been a pretty hectic campaign. But I think you are right. Certainly one that at the end of the day is really going to be confined to only a few states.
Yeah, I'm just pouring one out for the North Carolina political reporters after what happened yesterday with the Republican gubernatorial candidate Mark Robinson's things that he allegedly did. But let's talk about Missouri. Like, Missouri is being watched nationally for another reason. It is one of a number of states that has a ballot measure to legalize abortion. Mm-hmm. I believe Florida and Arizona also have similar measures that would protect abortion rights. There are a couple of polls out this week showing what's known as Amendment 3 would pass. How much do you think the issue of abortion rights could matter as kind of a trickle-down effect in the presidential race, given that a lot of the swing states have similar abortion measures on the ballot?
I think it's the abortion as an issue is certainly going to have a huge impact. And we saw this in 2022, you know, even voters who kind of disapprove of, you know, the Biden-Harris administration's performance, and you know, might be kind of skeptical of them, you know, but are really supportive of abortion rights. That was kind of a key issue in 2022 that really swung people over to the Democrats' column. I think, you know, it's hard to be sure with the ballot initiatives. As you say, there are a lot of battleground states that will have them on the ballot. But I think, you know, we know better than anyone in Missouri that, you know, states can vote in really kind of progressive ways on ballot measures. We've seen that in Missouri several times, you know, with kind of right-to-work amendments and with medical marijuana and things like that, where there are kind of ballot issues that go in kind of the more liberal-leaning direction, but voters are really comfortable kind of splitting their ticket, so to speak, and kind of voting that way on ballot initiatives, but at the same time voting for, you know, in Missouri's case, Republicans, you know, all the way down the ballot. So I do think, you know, I'm hesitant to say it's necessarily going to be the clincher, because I do think we have a lot of evidence that voters are really comfortable kind of splitting their ballots in that way. I think there's no question, though, it's an issue that's really motivating Democrats. You see a lot of Democrats are really happy. You know, certainly can't hurt Democrats, and I think certainly won't help Republicans. That's why you see a lot of Democrats very happy that those are on the ballot. I think, you know, it's the same thing where you mentioned Mark Robinson, North Carolina. I think it's hard to be sure that, you know, there's the kind of reverse coattail effect, you know, that a lot of Democrats are hoping for, that things on the bottom of the ballot really help the people at the top of the ticket. I don't think there's so much electoral evidence of that over time, but I think, if anything, the more focus that there is on abortion rights, the more salient an issue it is in this election, the better it is for the Democratic ticket.
Well, the Mark Robinson fiasco yesterday did bring about fuzzy and warm memories of the Todd Akin fiasco in 2012, mm-hmm. where there was a reverse coattail effect for statewide races. Like, without Todd Akin, Claire McCaskill likely wouldn't have won another term. And not only did Jay Nixon win another term, but Jason Kander also won his election. So I could see that happening in terms of, like, the down ballot races. Mm-hmm. But it should be noted that Todd Akin imploded in a year that Mitt Romney won by 9 percentage points in Missouri. So I could see a scenario where that doesn't really play a role in whether Trump or Harris win. What do you think of my rambly but historic observation there?
No, I think that's a really good connection. I do think it does bring up the point that I think often we do see voters kind of bifurcating between state and federal races, where voters might often go one way in terms of, you know, kind of state elections, but will kind of feel differently about federal races, why you see oftentimes, you know, in very blue states, for example, kind of Republican governors getting elected, but then at the same time, people voting differently for Congress or president. I was also kind of having Akin flashbacks. I think it's, you know, especially as we saw yesterday, you know, the state party is standing behind it, but we saw a lot of Republicans kind of quietly and not so quietly kind of trying to nudge him off the ballot, just like they did with Akin. I was also kind of getting flashbacks. I think it is quite analogous, and it is quite striking to me, to be honest, kind of 12 years later, because that Akin nomination caused so many conversations among Republicans about the type of candidates that they were nominating and the kind of candidate quality issue that we've seen cycle after cycle. And it is quite striking to see 12 years later, you know, pretty much the same thing, that just like in that race, you know, in a very winnable race, in a Democratic seat that is still Democratic-held governorship that is very winnable for Republicans, you see them nominating a candidate that even before what came out yesterday, we knew had a lot of vulnerabilities, who we already knew was a Holocaust denier. We already knew these kinds of, you know, kind of crazy things, and yet was still nominated by the state party. I think you see Republicans kind of going through the same kind of cycle that we've seen cycle after cycle, and in many cases losing very winnable races because of the candidates they're nominated.
There was a reason Claire McCaskill apparently chugged a beer after Todd Akin won the nomination in 2012, because she knew she had helped nominate the weakest candidate. But Gabe, thank you so much for joining us today. Gabe Fleischer is a St. Louis area native and the author of Wake Up to Politics. You can subscribe to his work at wakeuptopolitics.com. Gabe, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today's episode was produced by Alex Hoyer and Jason Rosenbaum.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Dorr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.